Revived Thoughts is a production of Revive Studios.
This is Troy and Joel, and you are listening to Revive Thoughts.
Troy, it is our first ever Q&A episode. That's right. You've heard us promoting it for like the last 2 months. It has finally come to pass. People have written in. People have demanded answers. And we are here to talk about, to give answers freely. Do you have any announcement? Are we just going to jump into this? Do you have anything you want to talk about ahead of these questions?
Okay, so I had one thing I was going to say. It's not an announcement, but I always wondered, if you're listening right now, and this, if you're a new listener or somebody, like, you might not get this, but this is not an episode for Chubby Baker, okay? This is definitely an episode where Joel and I are going to chat it up a little bit. We might talk about things a little bit more relaxing. Now, don't get worried. We're going to answer questions. We actually have a lot of questions, but if you're just a pure business person, this might not be the episode for you. But what I was going to say was, does the audience know that we read that this is Troy and Joel and this is Revive Thoughts in every episode? Do they have you ever? I'm curious for you, audience. Did you know that we record that every single time fresh for you? We're not playing like an old audio. Every single time you hear that, I am reading it slightly different because I'm reading it every single time. So I that's my question to the audience. Did you know that? Could you tell?
I bet you there was at least one person out there that assumed that was just a pre-recorded intro that runs every
time. We have like the intro my wife did of, you know, you're listening to a Revive Studios, da da da, and then that is pre-recorded. And then I do wonder if people have caught that this is a fresh take every single time. Okay, no, we don't currently, I don't think, have any announcements that I mean, we have stuff we're working on. If you've heard us talk tales of the great book of Revive Thoughts, it's actually pretty much edited. So that phase of it is done, and we're about to get to the next phase of it, which is super great news. Please check out our YouTube channel. I've been putting up shorts. I have figured out. Okay, Joel can tell you, there are old men at technology, and then there is a fossil that is buried with a mummy, and that's where I'm at when it comes to technology. But
it's
it's really bad, but I figured out how to put pictures in my little YouTube videos now. It's really nice. It adds a lot. Of course, if you see them, you'll see me holding out a printed black and white photo because I've been printing pictures and holding them up to the camera. But that's not the only picture now. I also have other pictures too. So I'm getting pretty tech savvy, let me tell you. So please go ahead and subscribe to those. Give us likes and help us with the algorithm on YouTube. It helps more people learn about church history, which is very nice. Is all of our announcements.
Troy, I'm excited to jump in to questions from our listeners who have written in. And I thought, you know, let's start off with a nice, easy, chill one, something that, you know, we can just kind of...
So you're going with Rachel's first.
I'm going to go with Rachel's first. Women in the church. And okay, so Rachel writes in, she says, and we do get this, Rachel's not the only person that's asked this. We do get people that email in and ask this from time to time. And I don't know if we've ever answered it publicly on the show. So,
by the way, there were actually two different Rachels that wrote then. So if you're one of the Rachels and you're about to not hear your question, we did get your questions as well, and we will get to yours as well. So don't suddenly go, they didn't even read the right email. We did. There were two of you.
Rachel says, I was wondering why you haven't ever featured any sermons preached by women, unless I've missed it, but I've listened to most of your episodes. Is it because of your personal beliefs, or is it because there aren't any / many? Purely curious on my part. I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I love your show. Thanks for all of the work you do. Rachel. Now, I like how she actually did break this into two categories. There's the logistical, like, process of... you know, how we would go about that logistically, and then the personal belief side, which I believe, like, that's what people really want to know. When they write in with this question, they're like, where are you guys at on this whole thing?
We could take the safe road, the cop-out answer, and just say, well, you know, look, it's actually pretty difficult to find sermons by women throughout history. And to be honest, it is. I think in my time of doing this show, I've only ever seen two that would even, like, that I've ever even run into where there was a woman who was preaching or running a church or giving speeches that would even qualify as a sermon through history. So, and that's, we've been doing this for a long time. We're approaching the sixth year.
Well, and that's because, I mean, we live in our current era. This, I don't think, is a controversial thing to claim that this is the most progressive, liberal society has ever been when it comes to women in leadership and women in terms of religion and leadership. And it's also coinciding with the most technologically connected generation of all time. So not only do we have women that are preaching today's day and age, but it's very easy to find documentation of that. There's podcasts, there's YouTube videos, there's evidence of that everywhere. Both of those factors were not true historically. A, women weren't up at the pulpit, and B, if they were, it was not something that was being documented and recording us for us to now look back on and recreate for you.
It really just they weren't. I mean, there are very few. I'm sure somebody's writing an email and going, excuse me, you're forgetting about this extremely side cult movement in the 1293 to 900 and, you know, to 1297 that did allow women preachers before they all got burnt. Okay, yeah, you can find maybe some very obscure examples, but by and large, 99.9% of church history does not have women preaching. And that kind of leads us to our answer, which is, yeah, we could do the cop-out and we could say, oh, you know, we just can't find them. And that would be the easy answer, but we're going to just go ahead and tell you. Also, we do not approve of it. And I don't mean that in a mean way. If you go to, especially I live in Asia and you want to know the truth, there are a lot of churches here that have women pastors. And sometimes my students will say, hey, do you think they should be pastors? And I look at them and I feel very uncomfortable because on the one hand, I know that's their church they're going to, that they're really asking that question about. And I just say, look, I just feel comfortable sticking with the words of Scripture. And I do not see anything in Scripture that points to the case that women should be preaching. And I know somebody's going to write in and they're going to say, well, what about this deaconess here? Or what about the Judge Deborah? But 99.9% of church history has gone in this one direction. You may not be that overwhelmingly surprised to find that your favorite, I hope it were your favorite, church history podcast tends to agree with what most of church history has said on this subject. And I know that people have different perspectives on that. And look, I respect you to have that different perspective, but I also hope you can respect us to be where we're at and be comfortable with it.
And we don't talk about our own personal theology on the show very often. That's what you get with a Q&A episode. You get the cut through truth. We think it's pretty clear that in the Bible, God calls the man to be the leader of the church, just like he calls men to be the leader of the family, you know, and in the household, just like Christ is the bridegroom of the church. There's that leadership role. Not that, say, women can't do everything else. And we do get questions about, like, what if it's not a head pastor that's delivering this message? What if it's like a political speech or something before like a lecture for a student body or things like that? Would we ever?
We went to a Bible college like that had the school would have been against women speaking, but then they invited Gracia Burnham. I did say her name wrong. Anyway, Gracia Burnham, the famous missionary, went to the Philippines. Her husband was lost, and we actually knew his son pretty well. In fact, Joel, you were his roommate at one point. So a very nice family, and we would hear her tell her story so I'm not saying there weren't maybe times where only she could tell that story to a chapel of students. You know what I'm saying? Like, there might be examples like that. But when it comes to preaching and exegeting the Word of God, that seems to be a role that pretty clearly is reserved in Scripture for men. We see that we're not here to make the theology case per se, because there are lots of great podcasts that can probably do that with more exceptional skill than we can. We always say that, the famous quote by Jonathan Edwards, you can encourage the faith by doctrine and precept and by example. We've chosen to kind of step aside from being doctrine and precept because there are so many great people doing that, and we wanted to emphasize the example. But with that said, I have just not been convinced that there is evidence that they should be. And if I'm honest, and this might sound mean, and I hope that this is forgivable and not too out of line, but I have, as somebody who has seen friends of mine kind of change perspective on this over time, and they'll start going to churches where women are pastors and stuff like that, I have not been convinced by the fruit of their life that it was a positive change to make. No one has shown me the example, as it were, where they started going to a church where the woman was a pastor or they were pro women in leadership, and I suddenly saw them really on fire for God. The truth of the matter is, usually when I see people starting to do that, it's very close to a very bad time in their faith.
That does seem to be the reality of it. And the thing is, I do know intellectually, you know, I read about, I hear from people that are, that do take a more egalitarian view, that are very strict in their literal interpretation of scripture and are very conservative. Like, I do know that that is a people that exists, that there, you can have an egalitarian view of women in leadership and still yet be very literal and very conservative in your interpretation of scriptures. I just don't know any personally.
I will say,
I have not come across that.
I'll help you out though. And this is also a little bit where culture can play into it. I, again, living in Asia, I know many, many different Asian churches. And we've been in China, which church there is very different. So I won't even use China as an example. But we've been in Cambodia. We've been in Indonesia. We've, you know, met with people who are from Korea, and we know people from all over. And I will say it is because Asia just has in general a bit of a more egalitarian view of these kinds of things. It's very common for a church to have women in leadership, and it is actually surprisingly, you will see that they actually are that conservative example. Well, they will be very strict by the book. They'll even be sometimes the King James version of whatever their language is in the Bible, but then they'll have a woman in, as a head. So it, over here, at least, it does happen, and it's, I think, a little bit of a different situation. I still don't think it would change my perspective. If push came to shove and they were to say, hey, give us your beliefs, I would still say, look, I'm not convinced that this is the best way. I don't think this is the best way the church is supposed to operate. But if you're looking for those examples in Asia, it does exist. Mm. It's different. And I personally think that, and again, when I look at scripture, I try to use not my own opinions, but just what I see in scripture. And then after I have my opinion, if I'm still confused, I go, well, how has the church tended to look at this through history? You know, what were the other ways of viewing this? And again, until about 100 years ago, church was almost completely unanimous. This is not the pulpit. And you could say, well, you know, there are times in history when the church supported slavery. Yeah, but the church was the one that ended slavery. And the church was the one that ended slavery in the Roman Empire too. Like, actually, most of church history, the church didn't support slavery. There were just two, actually really only one brief window of a few hundred years where that was something the church was kind of okay with. And even then, it was the Christians in the church that rose up and said, actually, we're against it. Women in preaching doesn't have that kind of back and forthing at all. It is clearly, until 100 years ago or so, it was very clear. Nobody thought that was what you were supposed to do.
Okay, I feel like we've officially offended all the people.
Poor
that,
Rachel. If Rachel is I'm like so was sorry, just an on it, yeah, we weren't trying to hammer it. We just wanted to be clear. Rachel, thank you for listening. I hope that doesn't turn you off from us. Hope we can still keep you around listening. You said you've been listening for a while and stuff, so we do appreciate you listening. And I hope our answer was sufficient. Even if you disagree, hopefully you can see the side of it we're coming from.
Okay, Phil wrote in with a plethora of questions. I'm going to return to them from time to time rather than just going through them all by one. But this first one he sends us, he says, how did y'all meet each other, Troy and Joel? Like, I know it was in Bible college, but is there anything specific there? A certain class or experience? How or what drew you guys together? Great question. I remember a first time we laid eyes on each other. Do you remember this?
You know, Joel, it's funny. Until you said it in that really goofy way you just said it, I would have been like, no, I don't remember meeting you. But the way you said it, I do actually remember now. We were both standing. We went to a small Bible college, yeah. A small Bible college in Kansas City. And I was from Florida. I had just driven there all night long to get there in time for like orientation and stuff. And we were standing, both of us were standing in the business line, like where you kind of had to check out your
It was
your
like the
register's
office.
Yeah, yeah. And you were with your, at the time, girlfriend, I should say. Yeah. And you said something funny. I don't remember what you said, but I remember you said something funny. And I laughed. I was like, that's a pretty funny joke. I don't know who that guy is, but he made me laugh.
Yeah, yeah. Standing in line in a register office. I think you were in front of me in line. And you turned around and introduced yourself. And boom, making friends in college was already, that's the secret. You just got to be the first person that you really meet. Besides the girlfriend that you were going to college with at the time, that did not last more than one semester, but you know, that's how it goes sometimes. But
hey, you met your wife there, so it worked out.
I did meet my wife there a few years later. Well, I didn't meet her that first year, but we didn't start dating until a few years later. But and then I remember it was a little bit later, but I did borrow a belt from you because I forgot a belt. Yep. I'm like, I know that Troy guy, he probably has his spare belt. But Troy was, I mean, Troy was easy. He's so approachable and he's so chill. He's easy for anyone to be friends with. Like, I don't know if you had any enemies there at Bible College. You were friends with everybody.
I definitely did. No, I just had. You are misremembering that story so much. I had enemies, but that's okay.
Gotcha. Yeah. No, I just had I had the privilege of just being the first person that that you met, which is an honor I will bestow upon myself. It's wonderful.
You were one of the first, and you were funny. You were a very relaxed, relatable guy as well, yourself. And you have and still always will, I think, have an amazing way to tell a story that you can really draw people in and make people laugh. I do remember some point in our first year, you were a loss prevention officer, and you could tell these wild stories of catching shoplifters and these criminals in action and stuff. And I remember just sitting around laughing and yucking it up with you and going, this guy is great. And at the time, you were not on campus. You were an off-campus student while we were there, but you were going to be on campus next year. And I was like your PR team. I told the whole school. I was like, yo, dude, you have no idea how great next year is going to be. Joel's going to be on campus. So hopefully by the time you got there, everyone was just waiting on bated breath for the great and illustrious Joel. And now you didn't let him down. I think you did a great job.
Oh, man. What a true friend. What a hype person. You know, you got me there. You want to read this one from Richard?
Yeah. Richard says, the joint episode with Elise on, quote, how to not teach church history was awesome. Thank you, Richard. Appreciate that. We were actually nervous about it. But then he says, when can we expect the how to teach church history episode? And in the meantime, are there any quick fire tips on how to do this well in a local church context? Okay, so you know what? You're not the first nor the only person.
That's not the first time I've seen that question come through.
And as I have answered in the past, you know, it's a lot easier to tell you how not to do something than it is to tell you how to do something. And I got to be honest with you. I don't know. Maybe it's because I teach some of these subjects to high schoolers and I see their eyes glaze over because they're high schoolers. And I go, man, am I just not doing it right? There are times when I can tell you that room is on pins and needles waiting for me to tell you what will happen next. And they love it. And then there are times where they are just like, is he still talking? Come on now. Now, I like to think that the second time is less common than the first. But I think that's why I'm nervous to tell you how to do it. It's much easier to tell you what you're doing wrong than to tell you what to do. But if I can give you some quick fire, surefire tips, here's my recommendation. So if you will look it up, you will Google, you'll spend time learning. If you read church history, you will find two problems that happens. You find A, the super mega history nerds, and I am one of those, who will just get into crazy amounts of details and they will go way, way below the surface. Now, it is not bad to teach the details. People do like details. Details are what makes life interesting. But you have to be careful. You have to teach these details in the right way. Don't over bog down your audience. Give them a little fresh taste of water and then get them out of there before you get buried in there, because it's that burying that ends up losing people in history. Also, and I will say this too, don't say you're teaching church history. There's something about the word history itself that is it has such bad marketing. It just flashes people back to their sixth grade class when they were hearing about the Phoenicians sold purple clothing, that their brain just turns off. They can't, it has a block there for people. So I don't tell them I'm teaching church history. I say, hey, let's talk about a story from the church. And I don't say the word history. I try to avoid that word because it turns their brains off in a way that I've literally taught a classroom, and I spent one time, I used the word history. And I could tell it was a struggle. I was fighting with them because their natural defenses against history were there. And so then another time I taught a class and I never used the word history. I just acted like it was just, these are stories about the church and we're going to learn about our faith through it. And I was talking midway through and I mentioned I was teaching multiple history classes and they were like, when are you teaching history? You don't teach history. You teach this other thing. I was like, yes, I don't teach history. You're right. I misspoke because we don't use that word because it really does. It puts up a wall there. And then one more thing, people love stories. People, where they can't, there's a reason why scripture, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, Judges, Joshua, there's Genesis, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Acts. There's a reason why so much of scripture is story related. And church history is so rich with stories. And I've seen so many people go to teach history and they just go straight for the theology. They go straight for the systematic theology stuff. They go straight for Paul's letters. And yes, Paul's letters are great and awesome and obviously the word of God, but people also love stories sometimes. And you've got to hook them on the story. You've got to get those, especially when they're new. If they've been reading and loving church history for years, yeah, bring them in on the theology. They're fine. They're going to be all for it. But if they're new and you're trying to entice them, starting with, here's why, you know, here's why this random obscure cult was bad back in the day, unless you have like cool stories about the cult kidnapping people or something. Like, there's not going to be that interesting to, oh, that's why that one type of Santa Menianism actually is bad, because that's not, their brains are turning off. They just don't conceive the world that way. But when you get them gripped into a story, when you grab them and say, hey, did you know this one time this guy did this and this happened, that's when they start to clue in. And we're working right now on a YouTube channel where we're putting up these shorts, and we're getting comments and likes, and people are messaging us and stuff, and they're saying they love it because they're just short stories. And that's something that I think the faith really needs more of. So how would you do this in a local church context? I know that a great guy who does a lot of this stuff is Keith Foskey. He literally teaches church history classes at his church, and we're actually going to have him on the show soon to talk about that. That's one way you can do it. If you can't get your church behind that, maybe you're not a pastor, or maybe the small groups about it are cool. You should use Revived Thought sermons for a small group. That'd be awesome, right? Maybe it's an idea. But if you can't do all that, just put it in your sermon sometimes. Use a story. If you're trying to think of a story to relate, just, hey, is there a story from church history that maybe can fit and tell this better than I can? I have opportunities to preach, and sometimes I just pull a quote or a story quickly from Hudson Taylor or Charles Spurgeon or one of those guys, and I fit them in. And I find that people actually can really be invested and enjoy those things. I'm not saying it should ever replace scripture. I'm just saying bring it alongside the scripture. You can find a lot of good analogies and examples of the church moving through history, and it can really grip an audience. It was D.L. Moody who said, an anecdote or a good story can stick with a person long after the doctrine of that moment, that systematic doctrine line has faded into their memory.
Wonderful. So when you're teaching and you're getting these ideas, you just need to start cataloging and compiling all of these tips that you have so that you can actually formulate it into a solid episode, your instructional guide about how to teach church history.
And then I can put it into a book that we can sell in 10 to 20 years.
You have the experience, the setting to perfect these processes. So you need it formulated into a way that you can articulate and tell everybody what the best way is for this.
Yeah, I'm experimenting in my class. It's getting better. I'm getting better at it.
Yeah. Okay, back to Phil. He wants to know, A, how did we meet our spouses? And B, if we have any special Valentine's Day plans, if there's any traditions or anything that we do, anything meaningful, that sort of thing.
Okay. Joel, why don't you take it away? Start that one off for us.
We both met our spouses at that same Bible college where we met. Troy was dating his wife before I was dating my wife, and it just so happened. So I knew of the woman. Her name is Sarah, my wife. I knew of Sarah my whole time there, just because it's a small Bible college, and we both dated other people throughout the years, and it wasn't until our last year there that we both ended up being single, and Troy was dating his wife at the time, and it just so happened that his wife and my wife were best friends, and Troy and I were best friends, and so it became a natural plot hatched by Troy and Elise to set up these double dates with us, so that way they wouldn't have, we can just all go on a double date and both hang out with our best friends all at the same time. I mean, it was painfully obvious and wildly awkward, but it did work in the end, so it can't be that bad. Is that your recollection of it, Troy, or is that
I will say,
do you remember it differently?
I was very casual. I was like, hey, if they work out, great.
That's true, it was mainly your wife.
But man, Elise, she was convinced. She was like, I see a vision here. She and it was more than just this would make scheduling friendship hangouts easier. She really did. She was like, I feel that these two people would be really nice together. And she was like, I have a plan. So it was her vision. And you know what? You're married. You have two kids.
She's right.
She was correct. Her gut was good on that one. So I approve her on that. We met at Bible college. And for me and Elise, same story. I met her my first year, and we both clicked it off on very nerdy subjects of politics and history. And I was like, wow, this girl is pretty cool. And so for me, I just, it was a natural clicking there for us. But any special plans for V-Day? It is hard to get babysitters in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. But we do have one. We're going to have a babysitter. I don't think we'll end up having actual Valentine's Day itself, but we kind of usually get a day near Valentine's Day where we kind of celebrate it on a different day. Any main habits or great things we do with our spouse? I honestly, like Elise and I, I don't know that it's a habit. We just talk to each other a lot. Like, we don't really watch a lot of television. We do watch stupid videos on YouTube, and we'll talk about things we see on Twitter and things like that. But we just hang out and chat a lot all the time. And we've always been able to just hang out and chat and laugh and goof for years. We are also, like, in all the same chat groups and stuff like that. All of our friends cross over, so we see funny memes, we send them to each other and all that kind of stuff. And I don't have any, it's nothing per se, like, this is some special secret sauce here. I just find that I'm really glad that I have my wife to talk so much to. A lot of ideas happen, a lot of great things going on, and I definitely can say, and, you know, if I can make a recommendation, if you want to be close to your wife, you want to have something, you want that hobby to come together, podcasting. Get a real YouTube. Just go ahead and both of you start a podcast. That gives you plenty to talk about and work on as well. You'll be quite busy with all the fun and joy that that brings.
Yeah. As far as Valentine's Day plans go, we might try to get out on a date sometime around the Valentine's era, but certainly not on Valentine's Day itself. And we usually, like, we'll try to get something cute for each other. Some low dollar item, like some sub $15 cute item, just to let them know that we're thinking of them. But, that's about it. Sarah's birthday is in February as well. And so, we kind of like celebrate and have a more elaborate gifts and more elaborate dates around that birthday. I feel like that kind of takes the place for that for us. But sorry, not much help for you as far as if you're looking for your Valentine's Day tips or advice. Oof, we are not delivering very well
I will say, this is a new one, but my wife recently bragged about me on a meal that I made. I only make one good meal. I make one good meal. I can make potatoes and eggs, and I make it all the time, but nobody has ever told me that was a good one. They just say, thanks for breakfast, Dad. But I make one good meal that I am able to make that will make people go, wow, that's pretty good. And it is chicken fried chicken with homemade french fries. The homemade french fries are easy. You just chop up some potatoes until they're french fries. The chicken fried chicken is an involved recipe, and I make my own sauce. It is a Freddy's sauce. If you've ever had Freddy's, the restaurant, I make a copycat of their french fry sauce and their seasoning. And I put it all together, and I make chicken fried chicken. One day I made this because I Googled, I wanted fried chicken. I didn't know how to make it, so I Googled how to make fried chicken. But it turned out I had Googled how to make something else called chicken fried chicken, which is much more like Raising Cane's or Zaxby's. It's pretty good, though, and I'm actually quite proud of my ability to make it. And my wife was in a group, and she was like, by the way, Troy made dinner the other day, and it was awesome. So you know what? If you haven't yet learned a single meal to make, look up one. Chicken fried chicken might be the way to her heart, with its own copycat Freddy sauce and your own homemade french fries. And if you live in Indonesia, so these things are far away, so she doesn't remember the taste of the originals, even better to pull it off. But so that's one piece of advice. If once in a while you can be like, honey, please, relax, I'm making dinner, and it's going to be good. That might be nice for her, too.
Yeah. Solid advice. Let's move on here. David, David asks on Twitter, this is a fascinating one. I don't have an answer off the top of my head, but I'm sure you probably will, Troy. What has been some of the most famous heretical preachers in history? That is an interesting question.
Joseph Smith would probably, I mean, he's got to be, the leader of Mormonism, tried to create a Christian kingdom in the desert. Like, he's got to be at least in the list, right? The guys who were the Anabaptists in Munster who tried to overthrow a city, they've got to be Hong Xiu Chuen over the Taiping Rebellion. So there's those famous examples of, like, way off. But I think you're actually asking who are the guys who, they kind of looked Christian, but they caused a lot of problems? Like, that's kind of what I think you're asking. Men like Robert Sandeman, who created the Sandemanians, which I have had to use that word way too often on the podcast lately. Yeah. But the guy who, created the idea that, Christians are just thinking about Jesus, but you have to think about him, you don't have to do this. And the answer is, that's really tough. And if I can actually say, I'm not sure, again, your obvious answers are, certain, maybe there's a couple popes in there who created some of the indulgence problems as well. Those guys are probably your big names that are causing problems. But I think the actual most damaging pastors are not actually your heretics. And I want to be careful. I don't mean that like, oh, so false teachers aren't. No, I'm not saying false teachers. Of course, false teachers are bad. There's tons of, most of the false teachers that are causing problems though are happening at your local church level, preying on a local congregation that are going to, you know what I mean? It's happening at a local level. I don't know that there's any mega false teacher movements, and maybe today there are more. But historically speaking, throughout most of church history, if you were to go buy the top 10 best-selling Christian books at your, imaginarily at your imaginary top 10 best-selling Christian books at your Christian bookstore, most of them probably would have been pretty solid books. I mean, 1800s, you would have had Charles Spurgeon, your D.L. Moody. You would have had a bunch of really great names at that bookstore. You go back to the 1700s, you would have had Jonathan Edwards, the Wesley brothers, Whitfield. You had a lot of great names at that bookstore, right? You go to the 1600s, you'd have had a bunch of Puritans. They would have had that bookstore underground somewhere, but it would have been a good bookstore. What's unique to now in our church history, I do think this is something unique to today, is that you go to the bookstore now, you go to the Christian bookstore now, and you're not seeing the best Christian teachers and people that you can firmly be confident in at that bookstore anymore. Your top 10 bestsellers at your local Christian store are probably books you wouldn't want to hand to somebody. Mm-hmm. And if if your friend's like, hey, I'm going to the Christian bookstore and they're a new Christian, you're going to be like, oh, hey, let me go with you and help you out because I'm a little bit nervous about what you might pick up at that store, right? Because we live uniquely, I think, in an era where false teaching like that is just out there. Historically, I don't know that that's been as much of a problem. There have always been deists and issues. The bigger issue has been compromisers, people who just kind of, they don't stand up. When they need to stand up, when the moment is calling them to be strong and stand firm in truth, they just kind of sit down. And so I think the bigger question would be, well, who are the most famous compromisers who kind of let things go the wrong way? That's a much bigger issue. Historically speaking, false teachers are rampant today, but you look at history, there always are some false teachers, but again, they wouldn't be running the bookstores as much. But these compromisers cause a lot of problems. But the hard part about that is, okay, well, who are the most famous compromisers? We don't know their names. Because the people who compromise tend to not make it to the history books because they get forgotten because of the very fact that they were courageous people who compromised. I hope that helps answer your question, David. I don't know if that was exactly what you were looking for. Of course, you have your big dogs, Arius and those guys who led to Arianism. But I think that the biggest issue, if you're running through church history, I think the big thing you're going to notice is there's groups of people who kept compromising on the faith and they would cause problems that would open the door for the other people to kind of come in.
Yeah, I mean, you opened it with what I thought. I mean, because I was trying to think of, like, who's had the biggest impact on society. And I feel like Joseph Smith is a pretty solid.
At least in the last 200 years, I think you'd have to say somebody like Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
Now, if you're going back to the earliest days, Arius is probably your clear winner. Arianism, people do not know. If you go back, after the Roman Empire fell, even during the Roman Empire, people will say Constantine, cultural Christianity took over. Bro, almost every single emperor after Constantine was an Arian. Like, he did not, the Council of Nicaea did not codify Nicene Christianity into the Roman Empire. There were so many battles that happened afterwards with Arian Christians. And the Gallic tribes that end up taking over most of Rome are mostly Arian. Like, people do not realize how incredibly close Nicene Christianity came to almost completely disappearing. I mean, there's a point where basically Ireland by St. Patrick, a few in Rome and a couple other, and like a tribe in France, that's the future Frank kingdom. Those are almost some of the only places where Nicene Christianity is in Europe at that point. And it's just wild how close it came to disappearing. Arian Christianity was ruling the land at one point. And it's a long time ago. We don't think about those things anymore. But then again, there are a lot of religions we don't think about anymore. Augustine was originally a Manichaean. Nobody worries about them anymore. But at one point, they were the number one religion in the world. So, you know, it is crazy to me how history works and how quickly a move. And I think that's actually kind of cool, how quickly a movement that once was so powerful, God can just kind of set it aside after a time.
Let's shift to a very serious question.
Absolutely. I know what question we're going to.
How does the food in Indonesia compare to China? That's from the Office Calvinist. Office Calvinist asks.
Yeah, he's over on Twitter. He asked that question. And let me tell you, I hate to offend. I liked the food better in China overall. Now, I really want to clarify. People will say, if you've ever met anybody, they'll say, okay, food in America is very different than food in China. When it comes to Chinese food, yes. The food, American Chinese food tastes very different. Sometimes it is significantly better. And sometimes, actually, the food in China is significantly better. It does depend on what you're getting. Now, there were many times I would go out to eat in China and the food would be like halfway cooked. The food would not be good and you would get sick to your stomach eating that. And that was not the food that I would say beats Indonesia. But when you went to a really nice, good restaurant where the food was made really well prepared, especially in North China where we lived the first year, you got some really amazing food. And that food tended to beat the food in Indonesia. They're very different though. In Indonesian food, it's much more, I don't know how to say it, it just, in general, it feels soupier than food in China. Like, there's much more of a soup vibe. Yeah. They like this kind of bread with sprinkles that they got kind of adopted from the Netherlands, but they also will throw, like, shredded cheese on a lot of stuff, but not in a way that I think improves the meal. It kind of just tastes like sour old cheese on a lot of random, like, it, almost all your bakery items will just have random sour old cheese kind of on it. And I'm not really sure why. And I really struggled with eating the food in Indonesia because, I mean, we've lived in a couple different places, China, Cambodia, America, obviously, and in Indonesia. And the food here was kind of difficult to adjust to because they really, in my opinion, have about five or six really good items and three of them are soups. And so outside of soups, you're not eating a lot of things that I think are like, wow, that's super good. But I have learned one of the secrets is you have to put spicy. You have to put spice on it. There's a spice here they love called sambal. At first time, a couple times I had it, and even though I'd lived in Cambodia and China, there's spicy food there as well, but this thing would just rip my tongue to pieces because it was spicy. It genuinely hurt. But I got over it because I had to learn to eat it. And I will say, it when you put that on a lot of their food, it does make the food taste a lot better. It's like eating McDonald's french fries without salt and then saying McDonald's doesn't know how to make french fries. Well, you got to have the salt on it, guys. Like, you can't ask for the meal to be halfway made, all right? The salt is part of that. And the same way, you've got to have that spicy pepper on the food in Indonesia to appreciate the food. And I did find that, you know what, I really did start to appreciate Indonesian food when I had it the right way. With that said, though, if you were to drop me, when my wife broke her foot, we had to go to Singapore to get it fixed. It was a big issue. Thank you for praying, those of you who did. Miraculous things happened that made it amazing. One thing that was nice, though, is Singapore has a lot of really good, high levels of quality and food cleaning Chinese food. So it was like Chinese food straight from China, but at the high quality of like a very first world clean nation. And I got to say, that was the cream of the crop. And I do love and miss just some of that classic good Chinese food. So if you had to drop me somewhere in the world and say you can only have Chinese food or Indonesian food, I'm probably going to pick Chinese food.
Troy, I'm sensing a theme in this episode today. I think we got a good candidate for a good spinoff show. Cooking with Troy, Food with Troy.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you can talk pretty sufficiently about your food preferences and recipes.
Yeah, I think people are craving that. That's why so many of these questions are food related. That's what it is.
Okay, let's keep moving. Patrick writes in and he says, what's your favorite episode with this Patrick? I keep hearing a lot of good things about this guy.
You know what? Sorry. I'll say? I'll give him an answer because I do have favorite episodes. And that is, Patrick has read like 13 episodes for us. Patrick is an amazing human. I love this guy. Genuinely a very good man. But I will also say, if he had to put a gun to my head and was like, you tell me my favorite right now, I'll say it. It's the old ones. Dude, you take difficult old sermons by people like Gregory of Nazianzus, these guys that lived 1800 years ago. I get nervous to send them. If I have a new speaker that I haven't really broken in yet, and they're like, I want to read a sermon for Revived Thoughts, they're imagining Charles Spurgeon or Jonathan Edwards. They're not imagining like this old Byzantine preacher kind of thing, right? And I appreciate that I can go, you know what, this is a difficult one. Let me send it to Patrick. I can confidently assume he's got it. And I don't have to stress about him getting broken by it. I don't hear from him for 3 months and then just get a response like, hey, I'm going to have to let you go, which happens. I understand if it happened to you and you've done it to me. Keep listening. I'm happy that you tried. But I appreciate Patrick that I don't have to stress. I know, hey, I'm going to send that to Patrick and it's going to come back to me at some point and it's going to be good. And he can handle those tough sermons.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah. He then goes on to ask, has there ever been works of fiction within the church history that you guys enjoy? Troy, maybe you can clarify. Is he talking about like historical fiction books that people in church history wrote? Is that what you were understanding?
So I actually did ask him a follow-up question. I was like, hey, can you clarify? Is this like, do we like church history fiction? Like a, or like, you know, like a story is kind of reimagining a church history moment, kind of like that alternative, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, that kind of thing. Or do you mean like good fiction that's important in church history? And he said, I'll take either. Like, he was down with either of those questions. So I'll go ahead and start with the first one. I have never read any church history fiction outside of like maybe some Torchbearer stuff to my kids, which I think is great. I do love those kind of things. Kids love them. And I think it's great to read church history stories. Oh, you know, back to how do you teach church history? Tell stories to your kids, man. Find some of those books. There are lots of them in the libraries and read them. Kids love those things. And they love those kind of like, oh, this is a cool story about the church. So do those where you can. But I haven't read anything outside that.
I wonder maybe like some Joan of Arc adaptations could fall into that category. Some of that stuff is pretty fictionalized.
Yes.
You know, we're taking events from church history and kind of making our own story around it type of thing.
You know what? What are we should start? We should write the Taiping Rebellion first alternative history story, a soldier following Hong Xiuquan around China as he eats rocks and does all the other weird stuff that he does.
What's your favorite written work? Fiction work from a person.
That's a difficult question because you're basically saying, okay, out of all the great Christian writers, which one's your favorite? And it's like, well, you got obvious ones like John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, right? That feels like, okay, you put that one down, safe answer. Everyone loves it. And of course I do too. But C.S. Lewis, some really great fiction. I mean, Screwtape Letters, Great Divorce. Mm-hmm. Both are fantastic. Obviously Chronicles of Narnia. Those are fantastic. But, you know, and this is, once again, where I kind of go, I'm a bit of a nerd here. I really love Dostoevsky. I love that Russian writer. He is a Christian, an Orthodox Russian Christian up there. But he really nailed, like, the world that was coming. And he lived in Russia at the time when, like, the revolutionary stuff was 1870s. Communists wouldn't take over Russia until 1918 or 19 or so. But it was kind of as if he saw the future coming and just wrote about it ahead of time. And it is amazing to read his books. They're full of twists. They're full of turns. And I love them. And again, he's just lambasting the future ideas of these revolutionaries. He's lambasting human nature in just really fun and interesting ways. And he is an extremely good at reading. It is a frantic, frenetic run. And then just the bits of Russian culture you get out of the book too are just always shocking. In one of the books, The Idiot, a guy basically is at a dinner party in the book and he's like, I'm going to kill myself. And everyone's kind of like, no, you're not. And he pulls out a gun. And he's like, no, I really am. And he puts the gun to his head and they're all still just like, nah, you're not going to do it. And then he pulls the trigger and the gun jams or didn't have a bullet in the right spot. And he goes, I didn't die. And they're like, see, we told you weren't going to do it. You're such a, and I'm just like, what? Like, I cannot imagine, you know, any English, British, or American author writing that story and everyone not freaking out and trying to help the guy and going like, oh my gosh. And in Russia, they all laughed it off like it was just a normal dinner party thing. I'm like, I don't know how true that is to Russia today, but it is just a different world reading their stories. You are definitely entering like a different way of viewing reality. And it is fascinating to me. So in terms of my favorite, it's usually something by him.
Never read anything by him. Maybe I'll add it to the reading list. I'll check it out.
They are long, but they really pull you in. You get kind of sucked into like this frantic, frenetic energy as everyone always feels like they're kind of running around doing crazy stuff. It's unique. If you haven't read one, it's a unique experience.
What's the author name again?
Dostoevsky. Fyodor Dostoevsky. 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 You know what? I apologize to everyone. I don't remember Dostoevsky or Dostoevsky or Oh gosh, I lost all credit there. Anyway, I've read like four of his books, and I still don't know how to say his name.
Okay, we got to keep moving, Troy. We got questions to get through. The episode is already creeping along, and we got more to go through. Christopher writes in, and he says, "How do you decide which topics to cover each week?" Troy, you're the researcher of the group. How do you decide which ones to cover?
I don't really have a set system.
Whatever surfaces.
It really just kind of comes together each week the way it does. I mean, especially right now, I will say the Lord has blessed us with a lot of people speaking and a lot of episodes. We are planned out quite a bit in advance, which is rare. Joel can tell you that is not the way it has been. There have been times where Joel will message me and be like, what sermon are we airing this week? And I'm like, I still don't know until I get a recording back.
It's so maybe coming. This one.
Let's record this one and hope it comes. And that's not a great way to run a show for years, but we got out of that. We're thankfully in this current moment, we seem to not be... We seem to not be in that era. So I do appreciate that. But honestly, I go looking for sermons. Sometimes I look up famous names. Sometimes I just look up famous moments in history and see if I can find. Sometimes, like with these circuit preachers I've featured before, I'm just like, I really like this group of people. Can I find some sermons by them? Sometimes it is just a topic. I'm like, hey, has anybody done a sermon on depression? Has anybody done a sermon on, you know, suicide or something like that? And then you just kind of find these really interesting things. And then sometimes you're just researching something unrelated and you find a sermon by Cotton Mather on pirates. And you're like, what is this doing here? And where has this been all my life? You never know. And it is crazy. We have found obscure sermons. There are sermons on our show that you can genuinely not find anywhere else on the internet. We have the only copies of many sermons, actually. And even the ones that we do have, other people have tried to do this show. There have been copycats that use speakers from our show, actually, at different points, which that one felt a little personal. And the reason those shows have not had the success we have had, and I'm not trying to brag or anything, but the reason those shows have not lasted is because you have to love it. You have to love reading these sermons and you have to edit these sermons and it has to be a joyful labor for the Lord to do it. And I do. I do love reading them. I walk away all the time from these sermons with a little bit of wisdom and a little bit of something I hadn't thought of before, and it encourages me. And then when I do the research on their life, which the other shows never do, they don't give you the background info, they don't edit the sermons. And when they don't give you that, you don't know the story of who you're listening to. And so there's no deeper connection. It's just a name on a page. And I tell you, those things really got to come together. I love these guys and I love the sermons. Only a couple times in the entire show's history have I edited a sermon. And then when I looked up the guy, I was like, oh no, I can't hear him. He's not a good guy. Really only one time, it was accidentally a Freemason, an interesting sermon. And about halfway through, I was like, he sure talks about building with bricks a lot. What's going on here? Anyway, that was a Freemason, so that's why. But that only happened one singular time, and pretty much every other time, the Lord, I feel like, has just helped. And I will say, I do believe the Lord helps. There have been times we have aired episodes and people messaged us and was like, I really needed that episode this week. There have been times where we put out sermons and I had been holding on to it or waiting for it to come back, or I had been editing it, but something, and then just that was the moment when it finally, all the pieces came together. What a famous one, right before COVID-19 started, and we had this sermon by Wycliffe, who lived during the Black Plague. We did a whole episode on the Black Plague. We were recording it, and as it's going out, COVID is happening. I'm like, what a great timing to talk about, you know, the world is kind of having a big, you know, fear of a pandemic. Oh, and by the way, do you want to hear about this time? The Black Plague really scared people. I don't know if the timing was, it felt perfect to me though. And so there's just things like that too, where sometimes I think the Lord just is like, and this is the right moment for this one. And this is the right moment for that one. It just kind of comes together.
Yeah. Listen to that passion, audience. You hear Troy? Oh my goodness. He's on fire. You neglected to mention, though, another source of inspiration, which is listeners. Some of our great episodes were written in from listeners that saying you should look at so and so or do an episode on so and so, or just suggestions or advice.
Yeah,
every once in a while, my wife or I will suggest something. I was just about to say
your wife actually pitched us George Matheson's Patience of Job, which is, I think, safe to say, our number one most requested sermon. Of like, hey, I want to read that sermon I just read. It was really, really good. And it is also a sermon, I can say, is we have the only copy of it on the internet. Fantastic. And there's a reason why I moved it into our future book. It was that good. And I had to re-edit it recently. And it really is that good of a sermon.
Yeah. Okay. Back to Phil. He says, do you have anything particularly exciting about the podcast in the near future? A certain episode, perhaps, or a possible conference? Books or deep dives, etc.
Okay, well, I can say we do have a deep dive coming up. I am very deep in the research weeds of a deep dive that I'm excited about on the Knights Templar. And I got to say,
yeah,
it's been fun. I've really enjoyed researching these guys. It's really going to be a good episode. It's like, if you are a Patreon or you've listened to our first Crusade episode, it was a great episode and I love that episode. And this is like the part two to the episode that I didn't know we were ever going to get to. But it's amazing how well it fits together. It is I told Joel before, it's the Chronicles of Narnia when they return to Narnia after the number two, and everything's kind of like, what happened to Narnia? It went crazy. Well, that's kind of what happened with the Knights Templar. Like, they came back. You go back to the middle, to the Holy Land 20 years after the Crusader States, and things have gotten a little bit crazy and wonky there. And so I've been really enjoying going through that. Lots of great episodes on the horizon. We have a sermon that came out during a plague, which is pretty cool. We have a sermon that came out. Actually, we have a lot of old sermons now that I'm looking at our list. We have Kyprian. We have a Lollard sermon. We have Fulgentius of Ruspe, which you've probably never even heard of. You have Athanasius and Hippolytus. Of our next like six or seven sermons, all of them are coming back from those olden days. And I love those sermons. So that'll be a lot of fun. So, we do have a lot of good stuff coming. Joel, why don't you go ahead and hit us up with that update on the conference? So you're our man on the field there, right? What have you got a good location?
Our completely free conference that we now cannot charge anything for because of your bold words and opinions on.
And why would we, Joel? We're moving in faith, so it'll be fine.
Maybe we'll have an offering. We'll do some type of open donation. Yeah. People can support it that way. Yes. Yeah, we'll see. But I mean, probably not this year, but maybe. Well, Troy is stateside this summer, so maybe it will work out.
The people are hungry for it, Joel. If you recall, we'll
never stop talking about it until it happens. So we got it.
Except at one point, we just need to start switching and then start talking about it in the past tense. And people will be like, was there a conference? Like, you know, it reminds me of that great speech given at the church history conference when so-and-so said, and yeah. We'll just keep naming random people that are famous. And they'll be like, they really had all those guys at this conference. Where was it?
I love it. And we do, we are on track to debut our book before the end of the year is the timeline that we can commit to, which we're excited about. It's people have been asking us to have a print collection of some of our favorite sermons for the longest time. And so just imagine Revive Thoughts, except in book form, where you'll have an introduction that summarizes the person, and then you can reference the sermon. I imagine it being a useful tool for preachers to be able to pull quotes out from, you know, from pastors in the past. Bust out your highlighter with this Revive Thoughts Volume 1 book for sure.
Yep, it'll be great. It's kind of crazy. It's this idea where we take the sermons that were written down and record them, and then we then take those same sermons and then we write them back down and give them to you. It'll be
it's
good.
It's a circle of life.
This is back in the plant. So then someday somebody can take those sermons and re-record them. Wait a second. But no, I think you guys are going to really like them. It's very close to being done. I did mention on a recent episode, I found it was much harder to edit them for a book than it is to edit them for somebody to record. And I did not realize how different those two worlds are. And Grammarly has taught me that I do not know grammar at all, apparently. So I have learned a lot about commas and where they go and don't go. I think it's going to be great. Then you're going to really enjoy this book when it gets out. I have been going through all of these sermons again to edit them and really hardcore the last 2 months or so. And I got to say, I love these sermons. These are truly, you walk away from each of the sermons, you're just kind of sitting there like, man, that's some good preaching. That's some good truth right there. And so I think you guys will too.
Just to reiterate, by edit, Troy means grammatically, succinctly summarize them into our current way we talk, into our current language, taking them out of the old King's English or whatever translation they came to from before, and putting it in common American tongue of the 21st century, which is a challenge because people don't talk today like they did back then. So
And then we take them from that form and then bring them back to a book form so that they look professional in your pages of your book, which is also a different language too. So you're right. We're not losing the meaning. And I'm doing this mostly by hand, so it's not an AI doing it. It's just me and Grammarly giving me advice as I go.
Yeah, I like the idea that 300 years from now, there's going to be a podcast where people are going to be like, this comes from Revive Thoughts Volume 1. We're going to read this sermon today.
Wow. It's fun. Of course, they won't be podcasts at that point. They'll be hypnocasts, and they just beam straight into your face or something. Yeah, but still, it'll be good.
This wasn't an actual specific Q&A question, but I get it about once every 3 months coming through the email, someone writes in and says, what's the song that's used in the outro credits of our podcast of Revive Thoughts? And I'm always happy to give it out because it's a bop. You know, it's a great song. I love how our podcast kind of, I don't know, there's a sound to it, right? There's like a comforting sound to the music that's used in our show. Yeah. It's like a mix between some like electronic dance song, but also like it's soothing at the same time.
I will say, Joel, you have the power right now in audio to just play a part of that song right now. And so I'm just going to assume that you do. That way the audience can feel it, that feeling. Although then they'll be confused. They'll think the episode is ending, but still. I will say, and you know what, Joel, this is going to be bold, and I hope you're ready for an opinion that I didn't know I had until 2 seconds ago, but I will, if I could go back to the beginning of our show, if I could go all the way back to the beginning, I think I would switch our intro and our outro. I would take the outro and make it the intro, and then the intro would become the outro.
Huh.
Because I really like the outro. It's really, it's catchy, and I almost feel like I associate the outro with Revive Thoughts more than I do the intro somehow.
I think I do too, yeah. Yeah, that is an interesting thing. I do remember back in the conceptual days, in the pre-production days of Revive Thoughts, I have a vivid memory of sitting on your couch in Florida with my laptop on my lap and us going through what felt like hundreds of songs trying to find one that we didn't hate for the podcast.
It was brutal. It was brutal.
But we got there. We found something in the end, yeah. So to answer everyone's questions, that song is named Lagoon, and it's by an artist called J.A.K., like abbreviated, J.A.K. Lagoon by J.A.K. And now you can look it up and listen to it on YouTube whenever you want and get your Revive Thoughts nostalgia fix without Troy and I talking over it all the time. Troy, we have two questions that are talking about deep dive suggestions back to back here. Phil and Todd, do you want to take that, run through those?
Yeah, I can hit those real fast. So both of these were deep and good questions. Maybe too good and too deep here. Phil asked, an idea for your next RT deep dive, what was the state of the church leading up to the Great Depression, and what role did she play through those events? Seems to me that hardships at this time period would have driven great numbers to the church, but sadly I haven't found much evidence to indicate that happening. Whatever the case, I thought you might be able to dig up some interesting stories and insight. I want to say that you have inspired the idea of an episode in the future. It won't, I think, necessarily just be the Great Depression. But if I can summarize, if I could give the thesis statement of that episode, it would just basically be these hard times, poor times and stuff, allow the church to come in and spread the gospel in ways that the church doesn't get to otherwise. And this actually, and I don't want to go like super political or anything here, so hopefully it doesn't go too wild offbeat, but one of the problems I think that people don't maybe recognize when they say like, hey, you know, government needs to do more, needs to feed more people, needs to house more people, and you'll even have Christians say, you know, if you really care about people, we want the government to step up and do these things. Well, when the government cuts somebody a check, gives somebody money, helps somebody have their housing, gives somebody health care, those kind of things, the gospel does not get shared. The government does not add into that check, and here's a gospel track, and, you know, come to church on Sunday. And I know that's a little bit out there, but historically, if we go back to most of history, when people needed healthcare, when people needed help from the doctor, when people needed help from food, or they needed these clothes, whatever these things they needed, that was some of the best moments when the church could kind of step in and say, we will help you, and also, please come see us at church. And yeah, you know what? There are people who would take that help and they wouldn't go to church, but there was an opportunity to share the gospel there. And I do think in our world today where we kind of hand those jobs that the church once did off to other people, we don't mean to. We don't even maybe recognize that's happening, but we're inadvertently passing off great opportunities for the church to help the poor and hurting. And it sounds like, okay, well, what if the church fails? Yeah, the church might, and we shouldn't, and we need to make sure we're stepping up and doing that. But just because the church may fail sometimes, it is important to remember we're dealing with souls, and as people who deal with souls, that is the most important thing. And so it's just interesting, historically speaking, you know, when there was a disease that came through town, there was this episode we talked about, J.C. Ryle, where people were getting this bad case of a fever, and J.C. Ryle, the pastor, went from house to house dipping tea bags into their mouths to get the tea and the nutrients these people needed personally. And those people were great congregants afterwards. I imagine they were, because this guy basically saved their life single-handedly. When the Black Plague came to town, Martin Luther opened his house. You know, these things that we don't really see the church doing anymore because the church has kind of relinquished that role. We need to get back to it. And so the same was happening, I think, during the Great Depression. Many times when people had nowhere else to turn, that's when the church was there. And I think that we need to keep being that doorway. We might get taken advantage of sometimes. That's going to probably happen. We want to minimize that, of course. But there are so many opportunities to share the gospel when people are in their lowest. And if they're running over to someone else that's not the church to get the job done, then they probably won't be hearing the gospel, and that's not what we want. Jacob's was, Troy and Joel, would you be able to do a deep dive on the history of Christianity in Indonesia? Probably, but I will be honest. It's not an easy subject to do. And I've talked to a friend of mine who's from the Netherlands a little bit about it. And I'll be honest too, it's not exactly a happy story. Yeah. Some people obviously came to Indonesia to do the right thing, but there were some things that the Netherlands did that wasn't super positive too. So it is I think it's an interesting idea. It might be something we can kind of cross over. Me and Elise can do maybe an episode together on that. But buckle up. There's going to be some parts where you go, ooh, why did they do that? Be prepared.
Yeah, I will say when I was in Indonesia, I did take time to go through the History of Indonesia Museum, and I found it quite fascinating, and I learned a lot. It is a fascinating and unique history, but yes, also quite a sad one. Maybe one day we'll talk about that. Troy is all things expert on Indonesia now. So
yeah, exactly. Uniquely qualified. I think what they really want to know is more about the Indonesian food. No, I'm just kidding.
Let me tell you about this hot sauce.
Exactly. I will say it's funny. I've lived here for now 2.5 years, and I definitely don't feel like an expert. I meet people who have been here for much longer than me, or obviously people who live here, they're clearly the true experts. But I meet these other people who have been around for a very long time, and some of the things they say, some of the stories they tell, some of the things life was like back then, and I'm like, whew, I am glad to be living in the right now. I'll just put it that way, because it used to be a lot harder to be in this side of the world. I'll put it that way. And phones and the internet and being able to order food off of your phone and be able to get delivery drivers. Not always. You can't always do those things. It's not, trust me, you may say, oh, you can order food off your phone, so you're just living pretty high life, are you? Well, the options are quite limited, let me tell you. But still, like, it's still a lot better than it was 20 years ago when those things didn't exist. You know, having translation apps and working through language on your phone and stuff, much easier. So, saying, it was a lot harder one time.
Let's end it out with Rachel. It's funny, we started with a Rachel, we're going to skip Todd?
You're going to skip poor Todd here?
Oh, my bad. Okay, let's do Todd, and then we'll end it with Rachel.
I'm sorry, Todd, this guy. Todd, by the way, a regular speaker on Revived Thoughts. He has helped us with a recent episode. He said, would you guys consider doing a deep dive on the impact of Christian fiction on the Christian mindset and understanding the Bible? The Inklings and G.K. Chesterton and others. I hadn't actually considered doing that, and I think it's a pretty good idea. That'd be pretty interesting. What do you think, Joel? I love literature and stuff like this. I'm all about
it. It's funny, that one kind of we should have lumped that in with that that other question from who's the one that did the
Patrick
was asking
it was from Patrick.
Yeah, that's right, Patrick. Yeah, we should have lumped it in with that one. Christian work of fiction and how that impacts. Yeah, it is an odd topic because Christian history and I don't know, its impact is something you want to try to usually keep pretty historical in nature. You know, like you don't want to diverge from reality a whole lot because it's something our faith is based in. And so we want to base our faith in something that's reality and not fictional. But also, it is fascinating. I do think it's an interesting thing to see how that's contributed towards the psychology and the mindset. I bet you there are probably some great leaders from history, maybe not even like Christian leaders, but like leaders in general that used Christianity as a tool to control their society and had some types of fiction drafted around their control.
I don't think he's referring to North Korea, though. I think he's thinking of, like, what's the impact that Christian fiction has had on Christians? He's thinking, like, Todd is referring to, like, Lord of the Rings or Chronicles of Narnia or, Pilgrim's Progress.
That was your read on that, huh?
His impact on Christian fiction, and then he specifically mentions the Inklings and G.K. Chesterton. So, like, as these people wrote stories, how did that impact the way Christians view the world? It's definitely what I think he's thinking of. I like where you were going, Joel. We're talking about, like, as people created these Christian mythos. You know, obviously, I apologize to our Catholic listeners, but the Catholic Church would be really guilty for some of those Christian fictions manipulations there, because a lot of their saints did supposedly some pretty interesting things.
Stuff like that,
Like when Saint Nicholas, after he died, he apparently oozed green blood and healed a whole town, according to the Catholic, what made him a saint. And I don't want to I don't want to say I doubt that miracle. I wasn't there, but I doubt that miracle. I don't think he actually did that. Sorry, Santa Claus didn't ooze green blood in the way I tell the story. Just saying. I do think it's interesting. I do think Christian fiction, I don't know if there's a full deep dive, but I could see a short episode talking about that because I do really love these topics. I will say just a quick direct answer. Thank you, Lord of the Rings. Because of the movies and the books, pastors have had wonderful analogy material that they can turn to. I've definitely been in churches where the pastor's like, it's kind of like when Gollum this or something like that. And you know what? Before Lord of the Rings was the analogy you used, it was in Chronicles of Narnia, it was Pilgrim's Progress. I cannot tell you how many times I've been editing a sermon. He's like, that's when Mr. Fairweather shows up or something like that. You know, that direct quote to Pilgrim's Progress had that humongous impact on sermons from Charles Spurgeon loved to quote Pilgrim's Progress. He always was mentioning. He has literally sermons. We have one called like Mr. Little Good Faith or something like that. Fiction did actually play a pretty big role. And G.K. Chesterton, his one's a little bit more interesting. I don't know too many people who are quoting him per se. I loved G.K. Chesterton.
I'm not familiar with the G.K. Chesterton.
You got G.K. Chesterton was C.S. Lewis before C.S. Lewis. Yeah. I would argue he's very good. I read his book Orthodoxy, and I read his book The Everlasting Man. There was a little bit of a slow part in The Everlasting Man, but still a great book. I really enjoyed them both. Here's the thing with G.K. Chesterton, it's actually very similar to C.S. Lewis. You'll be reading along and going, whoa, this is great. It's like he can see the future. How did he do this? And you'll get to a part and you're like, don't agree with any of that. All right, this part, now we're back to the good stuff again. And I'd kind of do the same thing with C.S. Lewis too, a little bit, where you're like, I don't know, what is he talking about here? Okay, back to the goods. G.K. Chesterton, he was a Catholic, so there'll be like little mentions of Mary and stuff where I'm kind of like, I don't know about that, my friend. But in general, really good overall. His when he would just start to say things like, the future will look like this, you're always about to read a quote that is just perfection. And he has my favorite paragraph on the sin of self-seriousness, of people who take themselves so seriously. He basically says, Satan did not fall. He fell by the weight of his own pride, of his own taking himself far too seriously caused him to toss and tumble, whereas the angels can fly because, what is the line? Oh my gosh, I'm blanking. I'm not, this is going to bother me. Joel, edit this out. I got to get this. Angels can fly. G.K. Chesterton. What is it?
We're waiting.
This is my favorite.
Troy is furiously typing away on his keyboard, trying to come up with this line.
It's the classic one. Why do the angels fly? Because they take themselves lightly. And I'm just like, that is such a good quote right there.
That's pretty good line. That's pretty
good. Chesterton. Fantastic. Should read them. Hey, guys, look, these guys had great. The last thing I'll say on this before, I do think it would make its own episode. It'd be very good. Maybe we should have some high literary scholar types to have on that episode.
I don't imagine myself being a whole lot of help. That is not a wheelhouse that I.
Sorry, again, Joel.
I got the highlights. Hey, I got your Pilgrim's Progress, Joel, and your C.S. Lewis's. But
when they write in and they're like, "Hey, I need to know all about camera equipment through church history," you're shining.
That is my time to shine.
When they're asking the lens cap question, Joel, they will be impressed with your ability.
You gotta
to blow
get the lens
away.
Cap right. You can't dabble with the lens cap.
Last thing I will say about that is pastors tend to be very well read. Today, we don't read a lot of that kind of fiction. And when people do read fiction, they read more for fun stories. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I will say, historically speaking, your pastors could read deep classic novels, and they would read lots of them, and they would be able to have those interesting, deep literary conversations with their congregation and pull nuggets from those so that they can enlighten the way. And I do think that's something, if I could encourage pastors, pick up the occasional classic book. It may not be your favorite thing to read. I don't recommend reading the ones you were recommended in high school. I recommend reading the Christian ones that you weren't recommended in high school. But it does give you a level of depth and conversation that I think can be very useful sometimes.
Okay, let's talk. Wrapping up the episode with questions from Rachel. Rachel is a two-parter. I'm going to start with the second part, and then we'll finish with the first part. But her second question has to do with a lot of the logistics around our recording, which I find fascinating. She says, so random, what's your game plan, or how do you guys get in the zone when you're recording an episode? For example, do you have a favorite coffee or tea in hand, a special chair, specifically organized or coordinated notes/talking points between you two, etc.? Additionally, how do you navigate time zone differences in recording? Is one of you always staying up late / getting up early? And those are all great questions. I'll start with time zones, because Troy and I happen to be pretty polar oppositely staged on the planet. So we're exactly 12 hours apart for most of the year, minus daylight savings. So his 12 a.m. is my 12 p.m., which makes recording, you know, it could be worse. It could be more frustrating, but essentially, so yeah, so it's my morning and his evening. He records, we usually record, not all the time, but we usually record my Friday morning and it's his Friday night. So yep. he's already lived through my whole day by the time he's recording.
Sometimes I gotta send you warnings and be like, hey, yeah, bro, watch out. It's gonna be crazy.
It's a crazy day today. And so I'm usually getting up at, well, like we've talked about it recently, I'm getting up at 7 a.m. because of our it's daylight savings right now. So my 7 a.m. is Troy's 8 a.m. or 8 p.m. But most of the year, I'll record at 8 a.m. and it'll be his 8 p.m. And that works pretty well. It's the best system we found so far to work. Yep. I don't even know your stance, Troy. I know for a while you were recording while standing. Is that still the case?
No,
tell me you have a chair now.
So that was only in Cambodia. And that was because when we were in Cambodia, we had this very frustrating system where we had to basically, houses in Indonesia and Cambodia and a lot of Asia are made of like basically pure concrete and they're giant echo chambers. And when you're making a podcast, you don't want an echoey room. And the only way it worked out in our tiny little apartment that we literally were in the top floor of a school, it used to be a classroom, they turned them into apartments. The only place we could record was in a wardrobe. They think a very tiny wardrobe is how you would have to look at it. Not a big Chronicles of Narnia fantasy one, but just like a very small one with jackets around you, and you would stand into it and you would record it. And it was rough, especially doing deep dives from that. It was kind of hard to record for like two or three hours standing up straight into that thing. Now we have our own room. We have sound panels up. We have a desk. Everything's softened. There's a carpet on the ground. I think it sounds quite nice. And I'm sitting, and actually only a couple months ago, we bought ourselves, over the summer, we got ourselves like a nice cushiony chair. And it's really nice. Honestly, this is great. The only problem is there's no air conditioning and it gets pretty hot. And I won't lie, when you're on hour two or three of recording, you are sweating in here because there's just no airflow and it is always humid here. So outside that. As for a drink, I sometimes do have a coffee, maybe sometimes a green tea, almost always like a thermos of water because, again, it's really hot in here. But Joel, I do miss, the people don't know this maybe, if they're newer listeners, there was once upon a time when Joel and I would be in the same room and we would record together. And it was a great 2 years when the podcast, we were both in the same city. We started the show, I was in Miami, and then eventually we had these 2 years in Kansas City and then Cambodia and Indonesia for me, and you stayed in Kansas City. I'd go over to your house and I'd go over to the fridge and you would give me this little drink, this little, some bubble water drink, sparkling water drink called Bubbly. And it was perfect. And I miss it every time. Right
just
now,
the, in my just the refreshing thing, you know,
it was,
you know what I
it
have
nice.
Sitting next to me right now, Troy?
I knew you did. I knew you would. I knew you still had them, you know?
I cracked that bad boy open for every recording and just a little bit of carbonation, just a little pep in your step, you know?
Yeah. I miss those. And I'm looking forward, Joel, to seeing you this summer and you going to the fridge and handing me at least one of those cold sparkling waters.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I have a home office here at my house. Although I also have a 1-year-old girl and a 4-year-old boy. And so that's why you're here, especially throughout this morning, a particularly fussy 1-year-old girl that I'm not sure why. She's grumpy this morning, but if you're hearing a child crying, it's almost certainly coming from my side, and it is frequent, but you know, the show must go on, so we kind of press through it. Yep.
If you hear a call to prayer, especially as we're getting closer to Ramadan, where they tend to call to pray a lot, I'll put it that way, and that's the most correct way I can put it, we will you'll hear that on my side, especially
coming from the Troy side.
That's if you're hearing call to prayer and kind of going on. Okay, that's gonna be Troy. If you're hearing a baby cry, Joel. If you hear those switched, let us know because I'll have some big questions.
Yeah. Okay. Last question for this episode of Revive Thoughts Q&A: which figure in church history has had the biggest impact on your life / spiritual walk, and why? That's a great question. Where do we begin? Where do we even go?
Which child do you love the most? It's not the same, but I mean, like, it really is, to me, that is such a, like, an extremely difficult question to answer. And so I'll let Joel go first. Well, I think the answer a little more.
I think this is pre Revive Thoughts. Obviously, Revive Thoughts can help form this a bit, but through in college, I really fell in love with Hudson Taylor. I really enjoyed reading his journal, his entries, his coverage. I really appreciated how he communicated back home, and that model of faith missions that he implemented so well. It was a big inspiration for me in, you know, some of my more formative spiritual years. And so Hudson Taylor definitely sticks with me as probably, just on a personal level, being one of the more impactful people that we've covered. And kind of along similar lines, I really appreciate George Mueller for a lot of those same reasons. He his humility and his faith missions model are pretty convicting and pretty humbling to see someone implement in those ways.
Wow. Okay, that's actually really funny to me because you definitely took two people right off the top of my list that I would have also mentioned. It's actually kind of crazy that after almost 6 years of doing this show, some of the very first people we ever covered are still two of the people I have to give credit to. If I was going to say early in my walks with God, I mean, we're talking before I ever went to Bible college, pretty very early. I'd not really been saved super long. I would have said C.S. Lewis. It was probably the first not the Bible Christian book I ever read was Screwtape Letters. And I think that book, more than anything, began to shape and make me realize I needed to learn a lot more about my faith. And I was not nearly in the stuff I learned from that book. It really helped me to begin to piece together the idea that I need to be a Christian in all aspects of my life. So if I'm talking about like had the biggest impact, I had to kind of give C.S. Lewis that credit. That book shaped my life in a way that I don't know if I would have made the steps, would have gone to Bible college, would have made those decisions I made, had it not been for that C.S. Lewis book getting in my hand when it did. In terms of people, though, that learning their life, George Mueller and Hudson Taylor are definitely two people that when I learn their stories, the way they live their life, we have a sermon by Hudson Taylor called Abiding in Christ. It is just a magnificent sermon. It is going into the book that we're working on. It is just a magnificent way to describe living in your faith. I can't even put into words, but it really transformed my way of looking at it. And George Mueller, I will sit here and I don't want to go too crazy out here. You might listen to this and go, I don't know. Okay, Troy, you sound a little goofy there, but I have, he basically says, just pray to God for your needs and trust him. And I have had to do that in my life. I got this gift card for when I was in seminary, and I could buy whatever book I wanted. And I went to the Christian bookshop at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, nice school, and I had a nice little bookshop, and there was a book by George Mueller, and I had already started Revive Thoughts at that time. I knew who he was. I was excited to read the book, and I read his diary. And it was like God put that book in my hands right when I needed it, because right at that same time, we were getting ready to go to Cambodia. And we were supposed to do all this mission fundraising and supporting to go to Cambodia, but we only had 2.5 months and we weren't very good at it. We'd met with like one or two people. We were terrible at telling people what we needed, and we just weren't salespeople in that way. And we just weren't. And I just looked at my wife. I said, I know this sounds crazy, but I think we're supposed to George Mueller this. I think we're just supposed to pray and tell God what we need and just kind of shut up and wait for God to send the money. And Joel, you were there during that time. I mean, you can attest to me. I don't think I ever said, hey, everybody, we need money. There's no Facebook post. We never did it. We just kind of quietly went forward. And if people wanted to donate money, we would say, here's the link. We have the link out there for people if they would like to, but we just hushed our mouths. And we prayed. And I remember I would just sit on the floor and pray to God and go, God, we needed unbelievable amounts of money because we had to do a 2-week quarantine in Cambodia because it was during that COVID era. And it was brutal. And we got to the first week of July and we still had we needed, I think it was $13,000. We had $1,000. And I was like, God, how? And I was like, but we're going to stick to it. And if we don't get the money, so be it, but we're going to do it. And in those 3 weeks, we got it all. And it came from listeners. Half of it came from people we have never met, people who are listening to this show, who just emailed us and said, hey, I just think I'm supposed to bring this money. We hadn't told you, but you just knew. And I was like, man. So in terms of my faith, and that's happened not just that one time, it has happened to me multiples of times. So I will say, if you've never read George Mueller's diary, if you've never interacted with God in that way, I really do. I got to say that in terms of just making me learn to walk in faith, I do think George Mueller probably is the guy who most made me go, wow, when I look at the Bible and I see these people living in faith, this guy showed me it's still being done in the modern world, and it definitely changed my life. So thank you to George Mueller for writing that down and challenging us with that. And it's the scariest way to do things. I would definitely say that. I definitely have been challenged by it, but man, you just pray to God and say, God, this is what I need. I'm trusting you. And I will say I've seen it. I've seen it work in my life. And when you talk to people overseas, you'll probably meet other people who will say, yep, I've seen it work in my life too. It does. God will move in it. So I would say those are my guys.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Couldn't have thought of a better conclusion to this episode. what a perfect way to go out for this episode of Q&A. Maybe we'll have to do this annually. Maybe it'll be our Valentine's Day tradition. We'll have a Q&A episode.
I love it. What better way to remember St. Valentine, who died a martyr for the faith, than to have a fun Q&A where people ask us, what do we do with dates on our wives?
Well, thanks for everybody that wrote in. I do believe we got everybody. If there is someone that slipped through the cracks, I apologize. But I'm fairly certain we answered everything that came in. And so thanks for all that. Troy, do you have any notes on our way out?
I don't. I think other than just, hey, all of you who wrote in a question, thank you very much. And to all of you who listen, genuinely, thank you very much. I love hearing from you. I love reading emails and messages. Even the one stars can be funny when they come in at times, and it's just been great. I can speak with Joel, I think, too. We love doing this. This has been such a blessing, and I hope we can hear from you many more times, and we can continue to have these kind of conversations, questions, and just have fun with it, because it is a genuine joy to be able to do this for y'all.
All right. This is Troy and Joel, and this is Revived Thoughts.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. We ask that you kindly not be that guy, and instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone from their top brands in any condition on any unlimited plan for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 with Galaxy AI.
With new line on my plan, additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.